Okay, thanks for coming along today. My name is Venerable Wipasiko, and we're going to be, well, I'm going to be reviewing Everything Arises, Everything Falls Away by Ajahn Chah and translated by Paul Breiter with a little bit of guidance and input, I think, from the monks in Bayagiri, like Ajahn Pasano, because that'll become a little bit relevant later. So the structure of my talk, I've structured it as best I can because I did find it a little bit difficult in terms of doing this review to try and put it all together like a normal book review, because there's not really a narrative as such. It's a collection of talks by Ajahn Chah, and obviously there's common themes bringing it all together, which is things like anicca, dukkha, anatta, unsatisfactoriness, non-self, and impermanence, which is the subtitle of the book, Teachings on Impermanence. Right. Okay, and the other sort of obviously main theme bringing it all together is the Four Noble Truths, as you would expect from a Buddhist book, particularly from Ajahn Chah. But it's not, like I say, there's not a narrative arc that you could really talk about, and there's not characters and things like that. So what I'm basically going to do is read out a sample from most of the chapters that resonated for me, with me, for whatever particular reason. Sometimes that's kind of hard to explain, but things that I enjoyed and got a lot out of. And then I'm just going to talk a little bit about those particular extracts and what I took from it. And then hopefully that at least gives you a flavour of what you're getting when you read this book, because I guess that's what it's about. If you want to think about reading it later, or maybe you've already read it and a bit curious about what others think about it. So yes, it might be a little bit disjointed in terms of the structure, but should be all right. At least you get a flavour for what's going on. And so just to briefly touch on the structure of the book, for those who don't know, it's divided into six chapters, or six parts, I should say. Right view, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self, points in meditation, and completing the path. So as you'll probably find out as well, as I'll sort of touch on, you know, these are somewhat arbitrary divisions. All of them kind of touch a little bit at least on most of these characteristics of dukkha and anatta and impermanence. But yeah, I guess it's just what the focus is in most of those talks. And there's also, as well as translations of Ajahn Chah's talks, there's also little stories from some of his disciples about Ajahn Chah. Doesn't tell you who wrote them, but just little snippets of his life and what it was like being a monk under Ajahn Chah, what his habits were and stuff. But that's not the main focus of the book, so I won't be talking about that too much. So, to kick off, I'm just going to start by reading from the very first chapter, actually. A little part which partly resonated with me, but I'll explain in a bit why I wanted to discuss it in a bit more detail as well. So here we go. If we don't understand the Dharma, if we don't know the mind and don't know phenomena, then the mind and its objects get mixed together. Then we are experiencing suffering and feel that our minds are suffering. We feel our minds are wandering, uncontrollable, experiencing different unhappy conditions, changing into different states. That's not really the case. There aren't many minds, but many phenomena. But if we aren't aware of ourselves, we don't know our mind, and so we follow after these things. People say, my mind is upset, my mind is unhappy, my mind is scattered. But that's not really true. The mind isn't anything, the defilements are. People think their minds aren't comfortable or happy, but actually the mind is the most comfortable and happy thing. When we experience the different unsatisfactory states, that is not the mind. Make note of this. When you're experiencing these things in the future, remember, Ajahn Chah said, this is not the mind. We are practicing to reach the mind, the old mind. This original mind is unconditioned. In it, there is no good or bad, long or short, black or white. But we are not content to remain with this mind because we don't look at and understand things clearly. Dharma is beyond the habits of the ordinary mind. Before we have trained well, we may mistake wrong for right and right for wrong. So it's necessary to listen to teaching and gain understanding of Dharma and be able to recognize Dharma in our own mind. Foolishness is in the mind, intelligence is in the mind. Darkness and illusion exist in the mind. Knowledge and illumination exist in the mind. It's like a dirty plate in your home that's filthy with grime and grease, or a dirty floor. Using soap to wash it, you can remove the dirt. When the dirt is gone, you have a clean plate or a clean floor. So I'll just leave it there. Now, so I guess one of the things that I took from that was partly this focus that Ajahn Chah often had on distinguishing between mind and mind objects, something like between the knower and the known, something like that. But the other reason I sort of picked up on it was because of this mention of the phrase original mind. And for people who aren't familiar with that, that's a term that's often used primarily in Mahayana Buddhism, and as well as by some forest masters like Ajahn Mahabua. And there are different definitions you'll find of it when you look it up, but what it can often be referring to is this idea of some sort of eternal mind that's the kind of base of all things. Is quite similar to some ideas in Christian mysticism or Advaita Hinduism. And you may also know that Ajahn Brahm doesn't have much time for this idea. He points out, quite possibly correctly, that the suttas, that the whole point of Buddhism is nibbana, which means cessation. So it's a cessation of all things. There's no eternal mind that kind of goes on beyond the individuated self. That's, you know, not really Buddhism as such, or that's not the ultimate. The ultimate's nibbana, which is cessation. So I found this quite curious, and it was in the very... Thanks. Thank you. It was sort of in the very first chapter, so it was a little bit distracting for me, actually, because I thought, oh, God, I'm going to have to try and explain this or get my head around it when I do this review. So here we are. So I went and talked to Ajahn Brahm about it and asked what he thought about this idea, because I'd previously heard him say that Ajahn Chah never used this phrase. And Ajahn Brahm was quite surprised that it was in the book. He can't recall Ajahn Chah ever using it, and he was pretty perplexed as to why it would even be in there. So given that Ajahn Pasano had also been consulted about the translation, I contacted him. And he was good enough to email me back and say what he thought about it. Now, Ajahn Pasano's view on it is Ajahn Chah did use the term Jit Derm, which is the Thai word for original mind, basically, but he didn't mean it in the particular sense of an eternal kind of metaphysical entity. He was just using it as a way to distinguish between mind and mind objects. So when he's talking about original mind, he's probably talking about something like the undefiled mind free from objects of attention. So it's a little bit confusing, but that's basically where it's at. Well, yeah, it's often taken to be something like Buddha nature, but again, what that term means in Mahayana and what is used, I've heard Ajahn Chah, I think, use that. I think it means something a little bit different. So yes and no, depending on how you mean it. This is why it gets confusing. And that was also Ajahn Pasano's point, I think, is that the people like the forest masters like Ajahn Chah use these terms. They're not too fussed about the very specific meaning of it. It's just a way to encourage practice, and whatever motivates people, they'll kind of use it. But having said that, I do understand Ajahn Brahm's perplexity of it, because he gave me a copy of a talk that Ajahn Chah had given, or an interview Ajahn Chah had given to another monk, where he's Ajahn Chah doesn't even seem to know what the term really means. And apparently this talk was done not long before he had his stroke. So I'll just read out a bit of an extract there. So this is Ajahn Chah talking to start with. Then, though we experience that arising and passing away, there are, sorry, there's a little bit of a typo, are phenomena. No happiness or suffering follows because of it. There is not the continuous clinging and grasping as before. The mind must truly become like this. It must be seen in your own heart this way. Don't just be empty talk. Then wherever we are, we own nothing. Whatever arises and ceases. That's all. There is no more dependence on a speculative mind running after this. Questioner: this is the original mind or primordial mind, isn't it? Ajahn Chah: hey? Questioner: the original mind. Ajahn Chah: the what? Questioner: is there anything outside these five aggregates, i.e. body, feeling, perception, thought and consciousness? Is there anything at all that can be called the original mind? Ajahn Chah: they can call it original, but it's all gone. Just there, it's all gone. Questioner: you couldn't call this the original mind, could you? Ajahn Chah: label it if you like. You could call it that. If we don't give words to things, then we will have to stop talking. We won't have any words to communicate about this. There would be nothing to talk about. Ajahn Chah picks up a cup and moves it away, pointing to its original position, saying, that was its origin. That space was its primal original position. There is now nothing of this cup there. The spot contains nothing. That which can be spoken of is all part of conventional reality. That's all. The primordial, the original, that's just a way of speech. Without such conventional descriptions, there can be no understandable communication. So, I'm not going to come to any kind of firm conclusions about what exactly or whether Ajahn Chah used the term or not. It is mentioned several times in this book, right at the beginning. So, but I think what we can conclude is that if he did use it, he's probably not talking about some kind of eternal metaphysical mind or entity, like it's used in other traditions. So I'll probably just leave it at that. I don't want to spend too long on it, but I did want to talk about it a bit because it was a point of confusion for me, and threw a spanner in the works when I was trying to do a review, because that was in the very first chapter. But I think it's good to kind of discuss it a bit, and then when you read it, if you're not that fussed about it, just read it and get what you get from it. But if you are, you can have a think about the context and what he's trying to refer to then, and yeah, maybe follow up on it a bit more yourself if you're particularly interested. Sam? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many, it's very hard to say, but yeah, Ajahn Mahabua was the big one. Yeah. Ajahn Tate, right, yeah, okay, so then. But then, interestingly, Ajahn Medito was telling me that he asked Ajahn Gunhar about it, who's Ajahn Chah's nephew, and he had no idea what the word would mean. Yeah, so, yeah. Moving on. So I'm going to read a little bit more now, and one of the things I like about this next kind of extract is Ajahn Chah's very matter-of-fact approach to life and the inherent suffering of life. He's very kind of accepting of these things, and he just talks about things quite, perhaps not bluntly as such in this chapter, though he gets to it later, but just in a very kind of matter-of-fact manner. So this is starting on page 9, if you're following along. Where is the Dharma? The entire Dharma is sitting here with us. Whatever you experience is right, just as it is. When you've gotten old, don't think that's something wrong. When your back is aching, don't think that's some kind of mistake. If you are suffering, don't think that's wrong. If you're happy, don't think that's wrong. All of this is Dharma. Suffering is merely suffering. Happiness is merely happiness. Hot is merely hot. Cold is merely cold. It's not that I am suffering. Sorry, I am happy. I am suffering. I am good. I am bad. I gained something. I lost something. What is there that can be lost by a person? There's nothing at all. Gaining something is Dharma. Losing it is Dharma. Being happy and comfortable is Dharma. Being ill at ease is Dharma. It means not grasping onto all these conditions, but recognizing what they are. If you have happiness, you realize, oh, happiness is not permanent. If you are suffering, you realize, oh, suffering is not permanent. Oh, this is really good, that's not permanent. This is really bad, not permanent. They have their limits, so don't hold firmly onto them. The Buddha taught about impermanence. This is the way things are. They don't follow anyone's wishes. That is the noble truth. Impermanence rules the world, and that is something permanent. This is the point we are deluded at. So this is where you should be looking. Whatever occurs, recognize it as right. And then this goes on to page 41. Thus the Buddha taught to look in the present and see the impermanence of body and mind, of all phenomena as they appear and cease without grasping at any of it. If we can do this, we will experience peace. This peace comes because of letting go. Letting go comes about because of wisdom, the wisdom that comes from contemplation of impermanence, suffering and not self, the truth of experience and witnessing this truth in one's own mind. Practicing like this, we are continuously seeing clearly within our own minds. Phenomena arise and cease. Ceasing, there is new arising. Arising, there is ceasing. If we form attachment to what occurs, suffering comes about right there. If we are letting go, suffering will not come about. We see this in our own minds. We can gain real certainty about the Dharma when meditating like this. And we can come to the point where all we have to do is be looking at our minds in the present. We let go of that past and the future and look in the present, and we see the three characteristics continuously and in everything. Walking, there is impermanence. Standing, there is impermanence. Sitting, there is impermanence. That's the inherent truth in things. If you are looking for certainty or permanence, you can only find it in things being this way and not changing into some other way. When your view matures like this, you will be at peace. So yeah, as I was sort of saying, the Ajahn Chah's kind of matter-of-fact approach to life, you know, old age, sickness and death, this is all correct, this is all how it should be. And from that comes this peace. And it's, you know, it's not peculiar to Ajahn Chah, but I think he just makes a very kind of nice emphasis of it. Not making a big deal out of these things like old age, sickness and death, and therefore having a bit of peace from it when you accept these things in your life, because they're going to come to all of us. So I really like that about it. And you also, as I was saying, I think the three characteristics, the inseparability of them, of impermanence, suffering and not self, because of impermanence, which is what causes old age, sickness and death, or which is a representation of that, I suppose you'd say. You know, that's why we suffer, because there is old age, sickness and death, nothing can be permanent, and that's also why there's no self. But because there's no self, I suppose, if you can realise that wholly and fully and deeply, then you can have peace, because there's nothing really to lose by this impermanence. So, yeah, I think Ajahn Chah is maybe you don't quite get that from two little extracts, but that gives you a bit of sample of how he approaches these things. Next chapter is on dukkha. Now, the first bit I'm reading is on page 43, which is actually in the previous chapter, but it's talking about dukkha mainly, so I wanted to start there. It's got a kind of similar flavour, I suppose, to what I read out before as well. After I ordained in the Buddha's way, I started practicing, studying and then practicing, and faith came about. I would think about the lives of beings in the world. It all seemed very heart-rending and pitiful. What was so pitiful about it? All the rich people would soon die and have to leave their big houses behind, leaving the children and grandchildren to fight over the estate. When I saw such things happening, it got to me. It made me feel pity towards rich and poor alike, toward the wise and the foolish. Everyone living in this world was in the same boat. Reflecting on our own mortality, about the condition of the world and the lives of sentient beings, brings about detachment and dispassion. The Dharma caused such feelings to fill my heart, waking me. Whatever situation I met, I was awake and alert. It means I was beginning to have some kind of knowledge of Dharma. My mind was illumined and I realized many things. I experienced bliss, a real satisfaction and delight in my way of life. Okay. And page 59. We humans are trapped and imprisoned in this world and have troubles in such abundance, and we are always full of doubt, confusion and worry. This is no game. So there's something we need to get rid of. According to the way of spiritual cultivation, we should give up our bodies, give up ourselves. We have to resolve to give our lives to the pursuit of liberation. If we speak the subtle Dharma, most people will be frightened by it. They won't dare enter it. Even saying don't do evil, most people can't follow this. So I've sought all kinds of means to get this across. And one thing I often say is, no matter if we are delighted or upset, happy or suffering, shedding tears or singing songs, never mind. Living in this world, we are living in a cage. We don't get beyond this condition of being in it. Yeah, we don't get beyond this condition of being in a cage. Even if you are rich, you are living in a cage. If you are poor, you are living in a cage. If you sing and dance, you're singing and dancing in a cage. If you watch a movie, you're watching it in a cage. What is this cage? It's the cage of birth, the cage of aging, the cage of illness, the cage of death. In this way, we are imprisoned in the world. This is mine, that belongs to me. We don't know what we really are or what we're doing. Actually, all we are doing is accumulating suffering for ourselves. It's not something far away that causes our suffering, but we don't look at ourselves. However much happiness and comfort we may have, having been born, we cannot avoid aging, we must fall ill, and we must die. This is dukkha itself, here and now. So, I think that's a pretty good summary of suffering. And apart from, as I sort of said, I like his matter-of-fact approach. He's got these nice stark images, which if you read the suttas, the Buddha also uses some quite stark imagery when he's explaining things. And Ajahn Chah is using this image of us all being in a cage, and we're kind of trapped by the impermanence of our body. We're all going to suffer and die. We can't really control these things, and that's where the suffering comes from. But you can... He only touches it on it a little bit because this is a chapter on dukkha. But yeah, obviously there is some transcendence of these things as well, but we'll get to that later. And I also like the fact that he's really focusing on this idea that we're all in it together. We're all subject to these things, whether you're rich or poor, whatever your status in life, however smart or foolish you are, we're all going to have to go through these things. And that's one of the things I really liked about Buddhism, because there's this real emphasis on compassion for all beings, whereas personally myself, I found it, and probably still do find it a little bit easier to have compassion for, the poor and misfortunate than the rich and well-off. But it's important to remember that, yeah, we're all in the same boat, and that doesn't make that much difference at the end of the day. Hmm. So, moving on to points in meditation. How much? Oh, yeah, it's going all right for time. So, page 122. When the mind becomes tranquil, we are delighted. If we have a few days of peace from it, we feel it's really enjoyable. Then one day, all of a sudden, it's like sitting on a nest of biting ants. We can't sit, we can't do anything. The mind is so wild and agitated. So we ponder and try to figure out why it isn't like before. It was so peaceful for those few days, and we can't help but long for that experience to return. Right here, we are deluded. Conditions of mind change. They are not fixed, certain, or stable. That is their nature. That is always going to be the way they are. Whatever occurs is already something old. It is not anything different or unique, but is ruled by these same characteristics. We have to keep looking at the mind's reaction, the way it likes some things and dislikes others. We have liking, we feel pleased, and this is a sense of being pleased only. And this sense of being pleased only comes about because of delusion. It's not because we are in the right. If you are tranquil, don't get drunk on it. If you are distracted, don't get drunk. The Buddha taught not to be intoxicated. This applies to all experience without exception. If we are always wanting more and more, then we are always in a condition of disturbance. The Buddha thus said there is no wisdom in mere samatha. Tranquility meditation. In this samatha practice, first we may be tranquil because we are separated from external sense objects, not hearing sounds, not experiencing the objects of other senses. We can become peaceful. That's good in its own way. It's because we've escaped from things for a while. It's like certain illnesses such as cancer. It may not be noticeable for some time. There are no symptoms such as pain or swelling. So the person feels okay as long as the disease hasn't manifested. That's being in samatha and not noticing anything, feeling one has no defilement. But when we leave the tranquil environment and start encountering sights and sounds, we may be disturbed by those things. So then what can you do? Where can you stay in this world? Where can you go that you won't see, hear, smell, taste, or have physical contact with anything? The Buddha wanted our eyes to see things, our ears to hear sounds, our noses to know smells, our tongues to experience tastes, our bodies to feel hard and soft, cold and hot. He wanted us to have this full range of experience, not to live in total isolation. He wanted us to experience these things and realize, aha, this is the way things are. This is how we can come to wisdom. Even if we aren't doing sitting and walking meditation all the time, the mind can still be aware and on track. Practicing energetically without there being any loss or deterioration. One who is skillful practices Dharma in this way. So again, not surprisingly, Ajahn Chah is talking about impermanence here, and it's using the example of how our mind states change in meditation. If you've done a meditation retreat or much meditation at all, you would have experienced when you finally get a little bit of peace and things start seeming to be rolling along nicely, you experience a bit of tranquility, and then suddenly it changes and you don't know why. And you can't help, as Ajahn Chah says, most of us can't help but wanting these things back. But again, he's sort of making the point that that's just the way it is. That's the nature of the mind. It changes. You can't rely on these things. Even very important things like samatha meditation, tranquility meditation, and even I think he's talking about seclusion there as well. These things are important and necessary, I suppose. But still, they're going to change, and you can't rely on these things either. And I think this is a bit of a different emphasis than you get from Ajahn Brahm. It's not a contradiction of his teachings at all, but I very rarely hear Ajahn Brahm noting the limits of these things like samatha or seclusion and things like that, be it mental or physical seclusion. And that's not a criticism at all either. It's just, I think, it's interesting to note the way even Ajahn Brahm's teacher teaches a little bit differently from Ajahn Brahm, or vice versa. They've got different angles on that, and I find it quite useful to get different angles on basically the same thing. Hopefully, I don't think they do contradict in this instance, but sometimes you do get those contradictions or seeming contradictions, and they can cause a bit of confusion. But it's really nice when someone has a different way of explaining these things and different focus. You can get a lot more out of it. So that's what I quite enjoyed about that chapter in particular and Ajahn Chah's style in general. And the other thing I wanted to mention was, again, I really liked his encouraging us just to see things as they are. This is one of the things which I really enjoyed about Buddhism. What appealed to me when I was first learning about it was, I was always someone who wanted to understand the truth of things, and I tried to get that through reading mainly and learning. And sure, that's helpful to a point, but it wasn't until I started really meditating in Buddhism that, I started to realise, well, the only kind of truth that really matters is what our existence is and how we make the most of that. And that's what Buddhism, I think, does very well. And what Ajahn Chah explains very well is just keep looking at things, just keep noticing things all the time, and it gradually starts to make some sort of sense intuitively. So that's most of what I wanted to talk about in terms of the content. So I'll just summarise up a little bit now. So you probably guessed I did enjoy reading this book. I thought there was plenty of good information in there. It's told in quite an accessible way. And I think, anyone who reads it, whatever level you're kind of at, whether you're new to Buddhism or you've read and experienced quite a bit already, it's quite useful to hear Ajahn Chah's teachings. I heard some of these talks read out by Ajahn Amaro on the internet just after I'd done my first meditation retreat, and I didn't understand much of it at all, I must admit, but something still really resonated with me, and I think it was sort of, in hindsight, a lot of it was Ajahn Chah's kind of understanding of the pathos of life, the general dukkha that we all have to experience. But then it's not told in an uninspiring or depressing way at all. There's still the ability to make peace with that, and you make peace with it by understanding it and accepting it fully, which isn't that different, I'll just note, from what Ajahn Brahm says, of course, but he talks of it more in terms of contentment. But that's a lot of what I think Ajahn Chah is getting at, is just making peace with things and accepting them, and that is basically contentment. The only slight kind of drawbacks I found with this book was the talks are quite short, the translations. So each one I found I kind of would have liked to have kept reading for a bit more, which in a way shows that it's good content and I was enjoying it. But yeah, I would have liked slightly longer talks in there if possible, but maybe there's good reasons for that, because it was translated from old tapes, I believe, and possibly the quality wasn't even that good, I don't know. And then, of course, there was the confusion of the original mind debate, controversy, whatever you want to say. So that took me a little while to get my head around, and I didn't kind of really get into the book until, maybe about a third of the way through. But hopefully, now that it's explained a little bit, if you read it, or if you're just not that fussed about it anyway, you probably won't have that same experience. But other than that, I'll have a quick drink of water and questions, I guess. I'll have another drink. Okay, well, we don't have to have questions. There was one final part I was going to read out, if we have time, so I'll just read that out. Okay, this is in page 131, Making an End of Problems. Whatever the various dispositions of people may be, whatever desire, aversion, delusion, or pride they may have, the Buddha taught how to practice to reduce these things and eventually make an end of them. This is the best kind of knowledge. In the disciplines of worldly knowledge, various people study various things and gain various sorts of knowledge. Some attain to higher position and then consider themselves important. The result is that people can't get along and society becomes inharmonious. This is a way of external knowledge and disciplines. In the Buddhist way, we are willing to listen to the truth of things and try to gain understanding of what is true and correct. What's the point of that? It's for resolving our problems. Our practice of Dharma is for resolving all those problems we experience in the world, both our own and other people's, family problems, any kind of the many and difficult problems people face these days. There are many sorts of problems, but the Buddha taught the real and ultimate way to solve them. The real fact of the matter, the true solution, is that there is no one to solve problems, and there are no problems. There's no one to solve problems, so those problems don't actually exist. This is where it should end up. If there is someone solving problems, there are going to be lots of problems, and there won't be any end of it. That's the way of the world. In the way of Dharma, we say there is no one to solve problems and there are no problems. That's how we can make an end of it. That is the way to peace. If there is someone solving problems, there will always be problems. If we perceive the problems, then there is someone solving problems. Confusing, but good. Okay. Quick final chance for question. Yeah, go ahead. I was kind of afraid of this, but yeah. Well, it depends what you mean by the same, I suppose. And, you know, I'm not necessarily talking from good first-hand knowledge here, but my impression would be that it's the same, basically the same experience for everyone. That's what everyone's mind is like. But whether it's the same mind itself that everyone's experiencing, well, maybe, I suppose, but that's starting to, I think, veer towards more of this metaphysical kind of idea of eternalist or ground of all being sort of mind. When you start talking like that, I would suggest. So I would think, yeah, to call it the same thing, I think, is probably not quite correct, but maybe the same experience. Yeah, everyone's got a kind of blissful, clear mind. It's just clouded by all these defilements and things like that. So, yeah. Okay, done. Thank you.